From the studios of EWTN, this is Open Line with today's host, Colin Donovan. In North America, call toll-free 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985 or send an email to openline@ewtn.com.
Just having a little fun with Pedro, the producer.
So nobody knows.
Well, no one heard any of that, so the joke's on me at the end of the day. Welcome to EWTN's Open Line Friday. Not quite sure what you heard and what you didn't hear, quite frankly, as I tried to have a little fun with our producer Pedro, and, well, you know, it's just blown up in my face. What are you going to do? Welcome, welcome, welcome. If you would like to be part of the program, our very own Vice President of Theology, Colin Donovan, is in the house ready to take your questions. Pick up the phone and give us a call. The number is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're outside the United States and Canada, your number is 1-205-271-2985. And we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. And you can always send us an email. The email address is openline@ewtn.com. I'm Jack Williams. Pedro Quiles producing the program. Your call screener is Matt Gubensky. And Michael McCall monitoring our social media. If you're watching us on YouTube, or even if you're just listening to us by another platform, you can actually text your question to Colin. Just text your first name, how you're listening, and a brief question to the main call-in number, 833-288-3986. And our host, as he is every Friday, the aforementioned Colin Donovan. How are you?
Pretty ready to go. A little wet today, though.
Yeah, a little wet in Birmingham.
It is.
Dylan would like to know, should we believe that Homo sapiens are the only human species that possess the image of God?
Well, the definition of humanity philosophically is matter and soul, spirit. So if there were another species that had a soul as well as a material form, they would fall under the definition of human. The church neither says there is not, nor says that we should expect to. Obviously, I think in our age of science fiction and everything, a lot of people think, well, there might be life elsewhere. We're still looking for life here on this planet sometimes, certainly intelligence at times, but the church doesn't take a stand on that, and we will allow history and God to reveal the truth of the matter. Personally, I do not think that there is other life in the universe, but I have absolutely no basis other than my own opinion on which to state that.
833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. Marla wants to know if Catholics believe in the rapture.
We do. We believe it's at the end of the world when Christ comes again, and those who are alive after the persecution of the Antichrist and his destruction will go to meet the Lord in heaven, where God will be all in all. We do not believe it comes at some point that keeps us, takes us away from having to endure the cross. That is a profoundly unchristian and unscriptural dogma or teaching. That we are to expect relief from the cross when it is given to us in the providence of God. And basically, the non-Catholic vision of the rapture is escape from the trial of the end. No, what happened to Jesus, the greenwood, will happen in spades to us who are the dry, and he gave us the intimation of that as he was being taken to Calvary himself.
Couple of open lines still for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Kayla wants to know if it's morally acceptable to attend the funeral of someone who committed suicide.
I think it depends. The church does not readily grant anymore that is done as an act which is fully moral from the point of view of the will having embraced it and the clarity of knowing that that was forbidden by God and going ahead and doing it anyway. You know, that could be done precisely for that reason and be mortally sinful. So unless there is evidence of the of such a case, you know, so maybe somebody goes around robbing banks and just before the police pick them up, they kill themselves to spare themselves that punishment. That would be a scandalous case, I think, in that. Doesn't mean you can't pray for the person. Probably doesn't even mean that you can't have private masses offered for the repose of their soul in the hope that, yes, they had some moment of lucidity there at the end. But except for those kinds of scandalous cases, it is generally not going to be true that you can't go to the funeral of somebody who took their own life, because the church grants that, you know, medicine tells us a good deal about the state of mind of such individuals, and so we grant them the charity of not attributing to them the fully willful taking of their own life, absent evidence to the contrary.
And this is one of those cases where Holy Mother Church has really shown divine wisdom in that, as we have learned, as you just stated, as we have gained greater understanding of mental health, right. The church has evolved is not the word I'm looking for, but the church has adjusted her position accordingly.
Right. The church is growing in knowledge towards the full stature of Christ. We've passed through various intellectual revolutions in the history of the church, from the adoption of philosophical positions. At first, the early fathers were followers of Plato, and then later, of course, Aristotle and his realist metaphysics, which conforms very nicely to the reality of things in Catholic teaching. And in this day, this element of it, the very personal and human and subjective element of it, of what goes on in the heart and mind of a person as they, you know, do certain things, like take their own life. And as we've come to understand that more and more, we realize that we can't base on the external actions very often. We can in certain circumstances. But generally speaking, we're not going to prejudge their soul. They will get the absolutely perfectly just judgment. We don't have to do that. And so I think that's an understanding that certainly was part of the teaching of the Second Vatican Council in how we treat our co-Christian religionists, whether we go around condemning them for being in schism or in heresy, which we do not know whether they have morally done everything necessary to be guilty of that formally. And so the church has applied that in many domains, not just in sin and confessional situations, but also in terms of, say, the ecumenical and dialogic positions, how we treat others who do not have the benefits of a Catholic upbringing, Catholic formation, and the magisterium and the sacraments, which we have. And lacking that, we can find many excuses for them. And that is what the Church tries to do as often as possible, knowing that in the end, God will be the judge. And so we don't have to, you know, prejudge them.
A little follow-up question that Chuck in Nebraska has just called in. He wanted to know, do animals have a soul, and what makes some animals human?
Animals do not have a soul in the spiritual sense. In philosophical sense, it's very common to, especially those who followed Aristotle, to say that the formative principle in everything is, materially speaking, a soul. I think we would see today, in light of modern biology and genetics, we would see that in a large measure, the distinguishing of different natures, the cow from the horse, from the blade of grass, from the oak tree, from the microorganism, is a genetic question. So in a certain way, genetics has taken the place of the material soul, which Aristotle and other philosophers, including Aquinas, postulated for material objects, material realities only. But no, they don't have the soul in the spiritual sense. Only man has a spiritual soul. And of course, the angels have a spirit. We don't normally call it the soul, but it's a spirit as well. And they don't have a body. And that distinguishes us from them. And of course, God is not a creature. So he is simply God, and he's purely spiritual.
833-288-8255. EWTN. That's our toll-free number. It's an absolutely free telephone call anywhere in North America. 833-288-3986. Straight ahead, we'll talk to Rick in Jacksonville, Alabama, and we've got plenty of time for your calls as well. 833-288-3986. If you're outside the United States and Canada, we'd still love to speak with you. That number is 1-205-271-2985. And we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. And you can always send us that email. The email address is openline@ewtn.com. That's openline, all one word, at ewtn.com. It's EWTN's Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. If you have a question, call 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. Or send us an email to openline@ewtn.com.
You know, we talk a lot from time to time on many of these EWTN radio programs about the concept of sola scriptura that many of our separated brothers and sisters adhere to, the notion that the Bible is the end-all be-all and everything that you believe must be in there and everything in there must be something you believe. And Holy Mother Church has always stood on scripture and tradition. And one of the beauties of the Catholic tradition from day one when Jesus walked the earth and established his church, one of those tenets that we find from an extra-canonical source are the names of the parents of the Blessed Virgin Mary, Joachim and Anne, and we celebrate their feast this Sunday on July 26th. A couple of pretty integral people in the history of mankind.
You know, they are, and the only document that we know that has their names in it is actually one that the church in whole rejected. But the way to understand that is that any document, even an erroneous one, can also have true facts in it on many other things. So I suspect that there was already an oral tradition of that, which happened to be written down in the Proto-Evangelium of James, which is the apocryphal document that we're referring to. And so it just happens that looking back on that era, we think, well, here is where it was. No, I think the church knew that, knew the name. After all, you know, St. Luke talked to the woman herself, Mary, who certainly knew what her parents' names were, and maybe they didn't make it in the Bible for reasons of humility and focusing on the principal message, as Luke does in the Gospel and in Acts. But it is certainly part of the Catholic tradition to take them by those names.
You know, and we talk, you being a member of the Pontifical Marian Academy, are well aware, we talk much about the fiat of the Blessed Virgin Mary, but Joachim and Anne cooperated to a large degree to get us to that point.
Well, they did, and we could
think... With this daughter of theirs.
Exactly, and you know, you can think also of the parents of John the Baptist as well. This was the ordinary cooperation that we can all do, and that is to, Sister Lucy was told, Fatima was told when in one of the visions she had of our Lord, and wanting to know what penance to be done, the penance I ask is to fulfill the duties of your state and life. These are two couples, Mary and Joseph and Anne and Joachim, who fulfilled the duties of their state and life. They didn't have mystical insights necessarily. They may have. We don't know that. But in any case, they fulfilled those duties, and they, as did Zachary and Elizabeth. And out of that, we have the fruit of the great forerunner of Christ and the Messiah himself. And so We can imitate them to that extent if we fulfill the obligations that come to us as husband and wife, as parents, with regard to our own children.
To the phones we go. Rick is up first today, a first-time caller in Jacksonville, Alabama, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Rick, thanks so much for holding. You're on with Colin Donovan.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. My question was, in the book of Genesis, it seems like when I'm reading it, I started reading it again, but mm-hmm. There's one where the father was going to die, so the girls decided that they wanted to have babies, and they leave their father. A little bit of, and it seems like there's more of that, like incest, and God was accustomed to this. I mean, can you?
Sure. I guess you could watch a soap opera and see that kind of thing. This is a history of our human race, our fallen human race, and I think we see the things in the scriptures that illustrate the reasons why we had to have a redeemer, frankly. There's also this point. The church believes and understands, and St. Thomas is a great proponent of this, that the Adam and Eve were given an infused knowledge, a preternatural knowledge of the moral law and the moral order. We see in the early chapters of Genesis sort of the illustration of the ways in which the human race grew further and further away from God. And that seems to be the salvific purpose of those chapters, to show how far we actually devolved in from what God's intention was, a paradisical condition, a full knowledge of the moral law, and the grace to fulfill and keep it. So all of that had to be redone in Christ. And so we see the evidence of that in those accounts in sacred scripture. One part of that is God clearly did not promulgate parts of the moral law to those who could not observe it. Now, arguments are made, and I think St. Thomas and others have made this argument, that when humanity was young, intermarriage among relatives was not uncommon. Even if you look in our own ancestral trees, you'll find out that there are very often cousin marriages and so on, because these are the people you know, these are the people whose history you appreciate and understand, you know, and you do that. But any closer than that typically was not done, although we see historically that, yes, there were even between brothers and sisters and between the older generation and the younger generation. But those things are again, marks of our fall. Now, I think there is a passage which, for me, has really illuminated this, and it's one that has an ongoing application. In the Gospel of Matthew, in chapter 19, Jesus is asked why a man can't divorce his wife. After all, God allowed us to do that. Moses allowed us to do that, to write a writ of divorce and get rid of your wife. And the rabbis argue, well, what kind of basis would you need? And some of them, if she's not a good cook, go get a better cook. And, you know, trivial stuff like that. So they had their human explanations and reasons of what would justify a divorce. But what did Jesus say? He said that because of the hardness of your heart, he allowed you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. In other words, from Adam and Eve, it was not so. Marriage was a lifelong union, and it remains so by nature, whether you're a Catholic, a Christian, a Muslim, or anybody else. The marriage of one man and woman until death is the law of nature. The trouble is, nature doesn't promulgate itself very well, and many people abuse what makes common sense if you sit down and think about why that would be so. And so here Christ had to promulgate this moral law on a people who had been trying to follow God for 13 centuries. And yet he had to say to them, but I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for unchastity and marries another commits adultery. So God can be patient with us. He was patient with Israel, and he can be patient with us. And I think a lot of these things in Scripture, why did God ask for the capital punishment for certain kinds of things, adultery, religious crimes, and so on and so forth? And yet Jesus said regarding the adulterous woman, let those among you who is without sin throw the first stone. That's another example of this. Yes, that was the way God was given to teach the people the horror of these sins in his eyes. But now Jesus was saying, mercy and forgiveness is the law that I am giving you, rather than stoning. And he does it in a way that has the effect of them throwing their stones to the ground rather than carrying out the Mosaic law with regard to an adulterous woman. So this is the gentleness with which God treats us. And I think this is an important principle. When the church talks to us in our day, things which previously had been justified but perhaps no longer ought to be, war, capital punishment, and other things, we should reread this passage and ask ourselves, in these cases, is God calling us beyond simply what law requires to what mercy and justice and concern for the salvation of others would require? And I think that's the purpose of the way which God has treated us, as he treated the Israelites, treats us, and we are to treat such questions ourselves.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. We received an anonymous text, and the texter writes, I was the sponsor to my daughter-in-law joining the church. She has since then left my son for another man 3 times and is now filing for divorce. She says she's okay with God. My son says if I try to talk to her, I'll be wasting my breath. What is my responsibility as the sponsor? I do pray for her daily and at adoration.
Yeah. If you were the parent or the sponsor or the former husband, the responsibility would be the same. There would be no practical purpose for fraternal correction in this. And so fraternal correction to be received and acted upon needs the circumstances by which the expectation that the person listening to you will really, you know, take to heart what you've said, or at least be attentive enough that they might walk away and start thinking about it. Simply to go and confront her based on what she has done and the way she's acting, I mean, you might do that in a casual encounter and say, you really shouldn't be behaving this way towards your former husband or your husband, however you put that. But I think to seek out and to try to raise this point is, as your son is saying, probably a waste of your breath. It's certainly not obliged by charity. If an opportunity presents itself where it looks like it might be possible and fruitful, then sure. But absent that, I would think it may actually harden her rather than, open up her heart to the idea of returning to her husband in the church.
833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number. We've got wide open phone lines for you at 833-288-3986. I want to give you an invitation to check out Women Made New with our good friend Kristalina Evert. Saturdays at noon Eastern right here on EWTN Radio. Each week, Kristalina chats with her guests about the hard topics that women struggle with. She and her guests remind everyone it's never, ever too late to start over. Women Made New is women helping women. That's Saturday, noon Eastern, right here on EWTN Radio and Television. Right now, we would like to talk to you. Wide open phone lines, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. And don't go looking on EWTN Television for Kristalina and Women Made New, because that's actually only available on EWTN Radio. Most of the things that we promote are, but this one is not. This is only available on EWTN Radio, noon Eastern Time. 833-288-3986. It's Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
833-288-3986. EWTN is our toll-free number. Still some open lines for you and plenty of time for your calls at 833-288-3986. Patty is up next in Buffalo, New York, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Patty, you are on with Colin Donovan.
Hi, this is Patty. Should I repeat my question?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, sure. I'm wondering how you treat Catholic family members who perhaps don't go to church. And in that thinking, what did St. Thomas Aquinas mean when he said, do not communicate with heretics?
Well, you have to think of the times. At the times, there was... the heretics were very few, actually. We had just we did have the Albigensians, and we had others in Africa. We had those who denied different aspects of the faith, the truths regarding the incarnation and so on, the Nestorians and Pelagians and others. It's in that context, that historical context, that he was speaking. Now, in many other ways, this is almost, just an impractical thing from no other point of view. But the church is also, as I noted earlier, in trying to understand the culpability of individuals as were simply not simply their objective situation. So objectively, yes, non-Catholics are probably hold heresies materially, things that they believe are true, which are heresies as far as the Catholic Church, because they're not in communion with the Bishop of Rome. They are, by definition, in schism from the Church Christ founded, and you can say that about them. But none of them would acknowledge that to be the case. They're following traditions that they were raised in, or their grandparents, or their and some of them have been Lutherans, Anglicans, or whatever for many centuries, or have come to Christ through the knowledge of those religions. So rather than trying to make sort of external judgments of their status, the church would have us exercise charity and patience toward them. With the result that on the basis of that, then they would hope with the cooperation to their grace, because God will give them grace if they're open to the truth, cooperation with grace, they will be able to find not just Christ, but the church. And I think EWTN is a testimony to the truth of that approach. The numbers of non-Catholics who have come back to the church, the numbers of intellectuals who have come into the church, the numbers of non-Catholic pastors who have come into the church simply through the evangelization of EWTN, of Catholic Answers, and of other modern apostolates of the media of different kinds are enormous and producing great fruit. On the other hand, it's perfectly okay to identify something that is wrong by Catholic teaching and why it is wrong, and to give the counter arguments as to why a person's understanding of the scripture is actually incorrect, and that the Catholic Church holds the historical understanding of that scripture. All of that kind of apologetics effort is good. But to condemn people, that's for God. And this is where the church concludes differently from the past, because our times are different. We're not in the middle of denominational wars as we were in the late medieval period and the early Renaissance. So it's quite a different point in history. And so he's, like every human being, he's arguing out of his time in history and not ours. But we have the church to guide us in ours, and that's all we need.
Being mistaken is not in and of itself, doesn't in and of itself make you a heretic.
No, because you can hold it without moral fault.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. If we found that as a reason to criticize and judge another person and publicly condemn them and slander them on the basis of that, that would be the morally wrong thing for us to do.
Yeah.
Because we don't know where they are on that. They may, and many non-Catholics, Catholic Christians, love God better than many of us Catholic Christians.
For sure.
And we have to acknowledge that, and we have to give God and them the space to offer grace and for them to cooperate with grace and not simply assume their status in relationship to Christ and the church. That's why the Second Vatican Council was prepared to say that there are incomplete degrees of communion with the church. The best examples of that are the Eastern Orthodox churches, who have a true hierarchy, have the first millennium doctrines that we also possess. They don't understand the role of the Pope as we do, but they give to him an honorific role in the communion of Christian churches. And so, we should go at things from that point of view, from the way things are, and deal with the individuals we encounter on the basis of that, without making assumptions about their moral status with regard to Catholic teaching and communion with the church.
Does that help you out a little bit, Patty?
Yes, it does. Thank you. Is there any readings or anything or emails that I can go on to and look at and reiterate or read anything about this that on the show that's documented?
Well, you could get into the second part of the Summa where he talks about all of these questions of moral culpability. There's probably a good deal of that, but I would say between our website and Catholic Answers website, you could find many things on that.
Yeah, EWTN.com or Catholic.com. And if you just search heresy, and you're going to find all kinds of, or what is heresy would be a better...
Yeah, and you could also get it from the point of what is ecumenism, because there's a true, an authentic ecumenism which the church agrees with and promotes, and there is a false ecumenism which it rejects, which is to, admit the truth of other religions. The church is never going to say that the Lutheranism is a way God intended to get them to Christ and to God, to him. That's the church. That's Christ. That's the church. So you have to make a lot of distinctions, and that's why it's probably best to leave that to the professionals and just treat people where they are with the charity that you possess and help them find the truth when you know they're looking for it.
God bless you, Patty. Thanks so much for that great question. Still some open lines for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Next stop is Quincy, Illinois. Linda is a first-time caller listening on Covenant Radio Network Online. Linda, you are on with Colin Donovan.
Hello.
Hey, Linda. What's your question today?
My question is, I just finished a book, The Exorcist Files by Father Carlos Martin. And my question, what happens to a person's guardian angel when they're possessed?
Well, God only allows possession in very unique cases. It's not to be assumed. Obviously, an exorcist must first determine that there is truly such a case before an exorcism can be done and present his evidence of that to the bishop to get permission to do that. The person has a guardian angel. Obviously, we can't know what God has said, that the devil has been allowed or his fallen angels to do certain things to this individual, to obsess them if it's external or possess them if it's internal. Those kinds of things that... we can't know what the limits of that permission is. Presumably, the guardian angel knows those limits, and the guardian angel will be there praying, I'm assuming, for the person, even though they know that is the will of God himself that the person endure this trial with the object, hopefully, of being, since you can often get in, you can get into it, I'd be very hard-pressed to see a way in which you could get into it without some moral fault, even though you might be ignorant of the moral fault involved with the thing that you did. So people who get involved with the occult, for example, who get involved with Ouija boards, as actually happened, as The Exorcist, the movie from the 70s portrays, is based on a factual case. People who get, they don't go into that thinking, oh, I'm just waiting to get possessed by a demon. They go into it thinking it is harmless, and they find out it is not. So in that way, they're trapped by entering an area which they shouldn't enter. And I must caution, too, as well. I am not a big fan of the public conversation regarding exorcism cases. The church has historically had a traditional reticence to speak about these things. We know that they exist, and we can get inklings of them from, you know, public statements which are made. But the risk is we become fascinated with this field. That's a door. That's a door for the evil one to play with, to try turning the handle, to try getting into the room. So we have prayer, we have the sacraments, we have the rosary, we have the thing going to Mass, the things that we do as Catholics. That's the best protection from the demon. It's not reading books about what he does and how he's treated different people and being fascinated with that whole area. And I thoroughly in spades, squared, cubed, and quadrupled, discourage that completely, although it seems to be a modern Catholic fascination, but it's a wrong-headed one. You know, books in this domain, up until the 1980s, when the new Code of Canon Law came out, or actually the 60s, when Paul VI suppressed the old Index of Forbidden Books, you would never have found any of these books in popular discussions of this matter as legitimate reading for the Catholic. It would have been forbidden without the necessity of entering into that, say, as a theologian to study it or a priest to prepare for that particular ministry. And the Index of Forbidden Books was taken away. But when asked in another area, the question of Freemasonry in the 1980s, which wasn't specifically mentioned in the Code of Canon Law, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, who was the prefect for the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith in the 80s and under John Paul until the end of his life, he said, yes, the index was removed. Its moral value remains. And I apply that also to this area of the demonic and of exorcisms and the kinds of activities the devil is currently up to with different people in different parts of the world. And I strongly discourage anybody from going down that path because it's not a prudent path to go down.
Excuse me, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. We got a text from Sam in the Republic of Texas, Colin, and I think he's got a bit of a bad premise to part of this question.
Okay.
He says, how can I reconcile the excommunication of members of the Society of St. Pius X while Catholic politicians that openly advocate for abortion are not excommunicated by the church?
I don't know that you have any need to reconcile the two. Excommunication for ordaining a bishop without a papal mandate is an attack on the very nature of the church, because that authority falls to Peter and Peter alone. And historically, it's been various. In the Middle Ages, kings tried to, and there was the whole investiture controversy of kings and princes of kingdoms and so on. Princedoms wanted to appoint the bishops. And finally, the church got that whole thing settled in about the 1100s. And the Pope has very tightly held that authority, because he is the principle of communion in the Catholic Church. Colin Donovan isn't, Jack Williams isn't, the head of the SSPX isn't, Leo XIV is. And the Code of Canon Law makes that clear with regard to a mandate to ordain a bishop. So it's an attack at the very nature of the church and a separating of oneself from that church. Abortion is a great evil. The abortion is an evil that is condemned and earns an excommunication for the one who does it, and for those who assist in it. It would be the doctor, the nurses standing right there involved in doing it. Those people are excommunicated. People who promote
it, by virtue of their actions.
By virtue of their actions. The people who promote it, I think there ought to be a canon, what I call the culture of life canon. If you're teaching something contrary to the culture of life, euthanasia, transgenderism, abortion, There ought to be a prohibition of that. Nobody's listened to me. It hasn't happened yet, so I can't do it on my own. But that's not the case. There is no canonical penalty for doing that. Is there a moral penalty for promoting it? You bet. And anybody who thinks they can do it because the church doesn't forbid it, they're grossly mistaken. It is morally wrong to promote the killing of others, whether you're promoting the killing of black people in the South, of Jewish people in Nazi Germany, whatever the circumstance, to promote the killing of somebody as a political aim is morally wrong. And before God, there will be a price to pay for that. But there is no excommunication for doing that. So there are different categories of things. Of the two, that I think the killing of souls is far more is more evil than the taking of a human life. God will provide for those innocents in some way, but the person will pay a heavy price for the death of a soul through their own choice.
So let me ask you this: you take someone like a politician, not necessarily any public figure, but a public figure whose job is policy.
Yeah.
And to take publicly advocate for abortion rights, got to be pretty close to material cooperation, doesn't it?
Not really, because in our country, at least, the courts have made that determination, and now it's back in the hands of the politicians. I think there will be more guilt for politicians today than in 1973 with Roe v. Wade, where the court made that decision. And the court imposed it on the country. What do we have now is we have a state-by-state jurisprudence and legalization or prohibition. And so it falls down more to the state politicians today than it did in the past. So I think, yes, there is a greater weight. Before that, they could say simply, oh, well, it's a free woman is free to take the life of their court. Supreme Court said so. They can't say that anymore. They have to enshrine it in law in their state, and to be a part of that would be a material cooperation. And anybody who is a legislator who's thinking of this should read Evangelium Vitae, the encyclical on this matter in Pope John Paul II, where he describes exactly the degrees of cooperation that can be had. And you can, the only case that he says would be legitimate to be vote for a law regarding abortion, where two laws are presented and you only have the choice of keeping the more evil one from going into effect. You could vote for the lesser evil, not for the intention of supporting what it permits, but for the intention of stopping the greater evil. It's the same principle when you have two politicians, one of whom is a pro-abortion dingbat and another of whom is soft on abortion. Better to get the soft abortion one elected than it is the pro-abortion dingbat, because that's the purpose of voting for that person, soft abortion person, is to keep the other one from getting into power. To sit on your hands might also have some culpability if you can keep a greater evil from being occurring by supporting a lesser evil. Doesn't mean go promoting that lesser evil, but it might mean that doing everything in your power that the other one not be elected by voting for another person.
Gwen is up next in the great state of Michigan, listening on Ave Maria Radio today. Gwen, you're on with Colin Donovan.
Yes, thank you. And I just have an interesting predicament that's happening in my life, and I just wanted to see if you could help me figure out how to improve it. I'm a fairly new widow. It'll be a couple years soon, in a few months. And I'm a sociable person. I have had a deep faith in Jesus ever since I was 25. I was born Catholic, but I went to a retreat, and I've been actively serving Him through the years and trying to spread His love and be kind. And it just seems like the longer I go as a widow, I'm seeing two different personalities in me coming out, kind of. It's like, you know, I'm lonely in the evenings, of course, and I like people, and I'm a people person, so that's been difficult. And but then I have all of the male responsibilities, you know, that my husband took care of, that I have am responsible for now, and that's getting to be more of a frustration. It's just like, you know, I never swear, and I, all of a sudden I'm finding myself cursing and, you know, stomping my foot or something when mm-hmm. something doesn't go right and I need to call a plumber or I need to this or that, you know, and it's just, and I'm so surprised at that, and I apologize to the Lord right away for, you know, cursing or whatever, and sometimes I've just plain gotten mad at him, like, you know, I don't feel like you're here. Are you actually hearing me when I talk to you, you know, and I'm having all of these strange reactions to life in daily living that I never had before, and it kind of worries me. I, you know, and also, you know, I know the beauty of going to confession, and I don't want to go to confession now. I make all sorts of excuses, and I'm just so unlike myself spiritually in other ways sure. as well, but
yeah.
So I'm just, there's confusion there as to mm-hmm. what's going on.
Well, I don't know that I can diagnose that, you know, through a microphone, but, you know, I think I am myself an older person now. I find that that as you get older, some of your inhibitions may depart you, especially with regard to the younger generations, but not exclusively. So part of it may be a function of getting older and having that, you know, sense of yourself. I think part of it is you've diagnosed it yourself, your frustration a little bit with God and your circumstances. And I think that that's understandable. With regard to what you call the potty mouth, I think maybe you're going to have to do the, you know, there's a principle in morality and spirituality that if you want to acquire a virtue, you do the opposite of the thing you want to get rid of. You know, so maybe when you're tempted to do that, immediately turn to a prayer and maybe have a particular prayer, perhaps to your guardian angel, to the Blessed Mother or something like that, that you routinely say when you're tempted in that way or tempted by frustration, you know, with your plumbing or whatever it is. But to develop those counter habits, if you will. And I don't know that there's anything necessarily unusual about what you've described in your circumstances. It seems to me like a very human response to those circumstances. So you do have to lean against it and lean into it, as the saying goes. And part of that would be, you know, reacquiring the habit of confession. Don't look at it that the priest is going to judge you. Obviously, it's probably hard in anyone's parish to really have complete anonymity, but nonetheless, they've heard it all, they understand it all, and they certainly understand the struggles and frustrations of different stages of life. So be merciful on yourself and go to confession and try to develop some counter habits to those things that you're seeing in yourself that you don't like.
God bless you, Gwen. We'll keep you in our prayers. 833-288-EWTN. We're about at the end of the program, so we won't be able to take any more calls. But George is on the line, and I'm going to ask his question for him in the interest sure. of time. And he's kind of wondering if you can kind of help him juxtapose the excommunication of the ordaining bishops of the Society of St. Pius X while allowing the Chinese to ordain their own bishops
sure.
in that
yeah.
situation.
Well, like the previous question, it's apples and oranges. In a way, it is kind of the old investiture controversy, you know, revived. It's interesting, just this week, there had been a priest who was offered to be the bishop of a diocese, and Rome approved it. They had his biography on, I think, the Vatican News website, or no, it was in a press office bulletin that came out saying that Leo XIV had confirmed this name to be ordained a bishop. He had a good theological preparation. He went to overseas graduate school in scriptural theology in Korea. in other words, outside of the communist world. He had been a priest of the diocese for a number of years. He had been at the cathedral for a number of years, and was, you know, well known in the diocese. So it's likely a person that the church might have picked anyway. So what the Pope is trying to do is keep the sacraments alive, to keep the ordinations of priests going in those places. And as long as choices that seem to be as good as that are made, I think it's probably working out. And in other cases, it might not be working out. But that was the most recent one.
On behalf of our host, Colin Donovan, our producer, Pedro Quiles, our call screener, Matt Gubensky, and social media maven, Mr. Michael McCall, I'm Jack Williams. Thanks for another great week of EWTN's Open Line. Hope you have a terrific weekend. We'll see you on Monday. Until then, God bless.